morning. I'll reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. Marla Zink of the Washington Appellate Project, and I'm here on behalf of Mario Ontiveros this morning. While we raised several arguments in our briefing supporting reversal in this case, I'd like to focus here on the wholesale exclusion of Mr. Ontiveros' expert witness on false confessions. What Dr. Deborah Connolly would have testified to was to the risk factors associated with false confessions, that those risk factors were used here in the interview of Mario Ontiveros, and that those techniques had an effect that produced what one would expect in a false confession. This evidence was relevant, and it was helpful to the jury under 702, and it should have been admitted. Yet the trial court denied it wholesale, denying Mr. Ontiveros his defense.
When did that come up in the course of the trial? Was that a pretrial motion, or did it happen right as the officer was testifying, or when the state rested, or when?
It was a pretrial motion. It was handled pretrial. The report was submitted, I believe, before trial, and then it was discussed before trial, and it was renewed on a motion to reconsider. I think that that
I'm
was during the course
you
of trial.
I'm going to ask you about cross-examination of the officer, because as I understand it, this was a confession that was obtained over the phone by one officer.
Correct.
It wasn't a long period of time, but your client made a statement. And we've had a somewhat similar issue in cases that involve a request for a special instruction on the dangers of eyewitness identification. And cases have answered those in some our opinions have answered those in some cases by saying, well, if the trial court excludes it, it's not mandatory. I mean, the Ninth Circuit has an instruction that kind of mentions some of the factors you might want to take care of or think about if you're the jury. But one of the things that the cases have said is that, but those factors can certainly be used to cross-examine the officer. And I'm wondering whether in this case the considerations that are articulated by the expert, Connolly, were used in the cross-examination of the officer.
Sure, and I have a couple of responses to that, Your Honor. First of all, we were allowed to cross-examine the detective, obviously, and we were allowed to ask questions about the interview. But what we didn't have was information for the jury explaining why those techniques lead to false confessions, and at an increased rate that scientists in the field are very concerned about. So while a jury might be aware that, you know, if a road is wet, their tires are going to slip more, what they're not aware of is the stopping distance involved, the why that is, the mechanics of it, and an expert might be needed to explain that in a relevant case. And what we have here is a phenomenon that we know juries don't understand. The evidence in the record is that 73% believe that an innocent person would never confess, and a small percentage of that is only if there were, you know, extraordinarily coercive techniques used. And we also have that cited in the opening brief at 20 to 21. And then we also have Kelly Canary's affidavit that she regularly encounters this shock that someone who's actually innocent would confess. So we know that the jury doesn't know that. They don't have an inherent knowledge of it, and they haven't been exposed to that. The chance that anyone in the jury had falsely confessed in their own is minuscule. So this isn't something of personal experience.
The main thing you wanted the expert to be allowed to get up and say, you know, members of the jury, there was a confession here, and you're being asked to rely on it, but you should know that there are a number of cases out there where people have demonstrably confessed falsely.
That
would be the main point you wanted to make.
I don't know that I would agree that that's necessarily the main point. I think that's one of the points. I think the other important points is here is why scientists have found that people would falsely confess. Here are the risk factors, the techniques that detectives use to cause false confessions, and those techniques, thirdly, were used here. So those are the three things.
Well, as I understand it, the evidence would have been what caused people to confess, whether truthfully or falsely.
Well, and that
what the trial court judge found missing was the ability to inform the jurors of what they could look for to determine whether it was a false confession, not whether it was just a confession, or whether more confessions of both types were produced.
Well, I think that's an important distinction, and I think that's part of the misunderstanding that the trial court had here. What the evidence shows, what the science shows, is that the increase in false confessions when this technique is used is substantially greater, proportionally greater, than the increase in true confessions.
Where do we find that in the record?
Sure. If you give me just a second. So there are several places, and the first is the declaration in attachment 8 to the motion to reconsider at CP 249. It attaches an article, and I'd specifically urge the court to look at page 255 of that, CP 255. And that is explained and referenced both in the American Psychology of the Law Society's article at CP 774, and then also in Dr. Connolly's very own report at CP 802. And that's exactly what the concern
is here. You gave me 249, 255, 802, and what other page?
774. And that's the article from the American Psychological Law Society, their white paper.
In the Burns and Raffaele case, we struggled with this issue quite a bit. And one of the considerations was, I think it's kind of an emerging issue, but the cases that were offered at that time were cases that tended to show that where expert testimony on confessions has been admitted, it tends to be cases where there's some disability or deficiency on the part of the defendant.
Right.
And I don't think you have that here.
That's correct, and that actually highlights another common misunderstanding here.
Do you have a case anywhere else where, lacking that, the kind of testimony that you wanted to get in was admitted?
I have to think about the answer to that question, but let me explain to you why I don't think it matters. And that's that the evolution of this has been such that the understanding originally was that false confessions occurred when there were particular susceptibilities of individuals. That is still true under the science, but what is also true is that the average person is also more likely to falsely confess when these techniques are used. So the confluence of those two factors is obviously
the average innocent person.
Exactly. And so this is the particular susceptibilities of an individual characteristic are not necessarily critical if you have also the interview techniques. And I'll think about the case that might support that as well. Thank you.
Please, the court. I'm a self-fined deputy prosecuting attorney for Snohomish County, representing the respondent, the state of Washington. Admissibility of expert testimony is within the discretion of the trial court. It's only admissible if it's helpful to the jury, and it's within the court's discretion to decide that. Now, here we have testimony offered that purports to be their testimony of the subject of false confessions. It's helpful to the jury if it would help the jury decide whether the confession in this case was or was not false. But the testimony offered in terms of scientific basis was worthless for that purpose. This expert had no way of telling whether a particular confession was false or not false. What he had was certain techniques that increased the number of confessions, both false confessions and true confessions, obviously. That's why the officers use these techniques, in order to induce confessions, that hopefully true ones.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes.
I'm concerned about the trial court's ruling. It's possible that I'm misunderstanding it, but reading the portion that you've quoted in your brief, the last paragraph of that, he says, so the testimony is only relevant if the person, in fact, was innocent. And that is, of course, the ultimate question for the jury anyway, and so it is not useful to the trier of fact. Now, if I read just that, what that suggests to me is that trial judges figured out a rationale for never admitting expert testimony on the subject of confessions. Is that the position that you wish for us to take? Do you want us to endorse that reasoning?
No, and the correct analysis is set out by this court in Raffaele, which notes that the testimony has been held admissible when it concerns specific personality or mental attributes that rendered the defendant particularly vulnerable. I believe that all of the cases in which this has been held admissible fit within that description. And in fact, you received a statement of additional authorities yesterday citing the New York case of People v. Days, and that is yet another case where the personal attributes of the defendant contributed to a purportedly false confession.
But what about, you know, I'm aware of the Donovan Allen case down in southwestern Washington. I don't know if you are. That was a case where after 10 years of incarceration, the defendant was freed, and then the person who the DNA actually identified was tried, and an expert witness was put on by the state to talk about the coercive techniques that were used to extract the confession from the wrong person in the first place. So it seemed to me that, you know, it's troubling to hear about these cases. And I'm just wondering whether it is right to put that tight of a limitation on the admissibility of testimony. I understand that from your perspective, you probably are worried about the floodgates where every time there's a confession, there has to be an expert. But is there some middle ground between there has to be some documented susceptibility or lack of IQ and no, it doesn't come in?
The problem is the paucity of the science in this area. The suggestion is made that if certain techniques are used, the testimony, the confession is likely to be false. That's what they wanted to portray to the jury. But that conclusion has no basis for it. And if you look at the studies that they're citing, even under those studies, the large majority of confessions were true, not false. And the studies that they're citing have to do with laboratory techniques, you know, laboratory experiments with conditions don't bear very much resemblance to a person confessing to a serious sex crime. The problem is that there is no scientific way to distinguish
between false and true confessions. What you're getting at is you're saying, well, the testimony has to be somehow designed to help the jury reach its ultimate question, and I guess this would be right, of whether this particular person was making a true or a false confession. But, of course, the expert never knows that. So that doesn't seem to me to be the right analysis. I mean, isn't the problem to try to get an expert who can talk about how police are trained, for example? What is a good kind of interview? What is a bad kind of interview? What are the problems with the particular interview techniques that are used? I mean, it used to be the case, was it not, that when there's a child molestation or child rape case that you could, you know, we've changed. It's loosened up on whether you can criticize the interview techniques that are used with a child. Isn't that so?
Yes.
And so isn't this a similar situation? Can't there be a little loosening on the exploration of the kind of interview technique that is used to extract a confession from an adult?
Well, in
an adult accused of a crime.
Like most other questions of expert testimony, it remains within the discretion of the trial court. The question is not, can the court in some cases decide that this is useful? The question is, did the court in this case abuse its discretion?
Our task is to measure that against the parameters of the discretion, and it seems to me that trial courts generally tend to feel that there's not too much discretion in this area.
Yeah.
And in this case, there seems to be this idea that, well, unless the expert knows whether the person is innocent, then there's no point in having them testify.
You have to focus ultimately on what issue the jury is being asked to decide. They're not being asked to decide, was this a good interview or a bad interview? Was this case well investigated or not well investigated?
Well, that's not the question on the verdict form, but isn't that one of the things they can think about when they're deliberating on guilt?
Well, I would disagree, Your Honor, that the purpose of a trial is to decide whether the police investigated the case properly. The purpose of the trial is to decide on the results of their investigation. That is, has it produced sufficient evidence to persuade the jury of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, but I'm really not satisfied with that answer, because it seems to me in a child molestation case, you know, the jury isn't there to decide whether the child interviewer was, you know, a crackpot or somebody who was really experienced and knew what they were doing. But that may be one of the things they have to think about when they're deciding guilt or innocence of the defendant.
And, you know, one can look at the science of that carefully, but the question ultimately is, was this interview technique likely to produce inaccurate statements? And, you know, obviously that's not before the court today. I can't speak about what the extent of the science is in that case and to what degree they have linked.
Wouldn't it be more a question of, is this interview technique designed to override the will of the person? Now, I realize that there's always, there's a preliminary question of voluntariness, which the trial court decides. But that doesn't mean that it's taken away from the jury.
The question for the jury, however, is not whether it is voluntary in some abstract sense, but whether the conclusions are accurate, something that this expert doesn't know. I mean, look at what has been stated here today. Counsel has stated, and this is the most that she can say in light of this offer of proof, that these techniques increase the likelihood of a false confession. Well, that statement of itself is not very meaningful if you don't know what the base rate, which they don't know. I mean,
they're never going to know. Okay, let's just posit that they're not going to know, so that's convenient for the state's position, isn't it? Because then this testimony is never going to be relevant, unless you've got somebody who's got a really low IQ.
Yeah.
And yet, it is true, is it not, that, I don't have any scientific support for this either, but I suspect that most people who are not involved in the criminal justice system in any way are surprised to hear that people confess falsely. And yet they do.
I don't know if that statement is actually true. And in any event, it's a matter within the court's discretion.
The state asked for testimony to come in, let's say, in gang cases or prostitution cases. Reams of expert testimony about how pimps operate or how gangs operate, because that's something that the ordinary citizen is not familiar with and needs to understand in order to understand what it's being asked to decide when there's a specific thing that's going on that's kind of obscure. And you know, the techniques that are used in questioning a defendant by a police officer are not something that the ordinary citizen undergoes. I hope you would agree with me on that.
Neither this court nor any other that I know of has admitted expert testimony just to show that false confessions are possible. I don't think the state has ever claimed that false confessions are impossible. Never occur. And again, think of what the proposition here is. They say these techniques make a false confession more likely. Well, is that really surprising to the jury that if on the one hand, the police just go in and ask a question and instantly get a confession, or if, on the other hand, they are persistent and keep questioning and finally do, that the latter confession is more likely to be false than the former? That's really all the science here shows. This ruling was a proper exercise of the court's discretion, and the judgment should be affirmed.
The state's argument here and the trial court's discussion and ruling below have a critique of the science and say that the science is unfounded, but that's absolutely false. The entire American Psychological Law Society found this phenomenon so important that they issued a white paper that they spent years studying. The entire scientific community signed on to that.
So what part of the evidence would the jury turn to determine whether it should or should not believe the veracity of the confession in this case?
What the jury would turn to is Dr. Connolly's testimony about the techniques that lead to increased rates of false confessions and her stepping through the use of those techniques
and those
here.
And those techniques also lead to the increase in rates of true confession.
At a lower rate. So just like gunshot residue.
The lower rate. So they measured the lower rate, but have they measured the base rate?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, do they know that, to the start with, that 50% of confessions are true and 10% of confessions are false and the others can't be determined? Or what?
Yes, the same citations that I provided before, the start of that chart is when no techniques are used. So these identified techniques are then added in and quantified for the rate that changes the risk of a false confession.
And so was she going to say, in this case, these certain techniques were used, and so, therefore, my conclusion is that it was false?
To her conclusion, if she was allowed to testify with it, much like the conclusion or the instruction is in an accomplice liability testimony, would be that the jury should regard this confession with great caution because there is an increased rate of false confessions under this. And that's, again, just like any other evidence. The state's evidence that it gets in never shows 100% that something is true. So gunshot residue evidence, it doesn't show that
a gun... Experts often testify that they have a belief that their science or their educational endeavor, whatever it was, leads them to a to a personal expert opinion that something is more likely true than not true. Was she going to testify that something here was more likely true than not true?
Yes, that there was more likely to be a false confession under the when these techniques were used. If you look at the, I encourage the court to look closely at Dr. Connolly's report. It steps through everything, and the record in this case is great, and this is exactly the case where the court should rely on the record that it has to prove what everyone knows, which is that the science is correct on this. Juries don't know it. And again, I'd refer the court to the fact that juries don't know it. Judge Becker referenced not having the science. It's at the opening brief at 20 to 21. We cite several studies, including that 73% don't know it, and the CP 307 to 308. Also, and I can file a supplemental statement of authorities, but in terms of where it can be testified to without there being susceptibility in particular to this individual, Jimerson versus the state of Indiana is at least one example, 56 Northeast 3rd, 117, a 2016 case. Thank you, Your Honors. Next up.